Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Metropolis. It is January 31st, 2024. My name is Colin Dazipa. Today we're going to be talking about the Cominfront strikes. They've mostly wrapped up at this point. There's some contracts still being negotiated, being put to vote. But what the hell was that? Some people have called it the largest labor action in North American history. And I'm here with one of the people who did, who called it that. Felix Fox, part-time professor at Dawson Concordia, McGill, as well as a proud member of the Confédération des Syndicats Nationaux, or the CSN. You're a proud member of the FNIC union that represents teachers. PhD in English from McGill University in 2021, and focusing mostly on post-colonial literature and globalization. Today, Felix is here to talk about your perspective as a union member and also just general labor activist, supporter of labor rights. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about here, but how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
not too bad.
I'm not sure I would call myself a labor activist, but I guess, like, I don't know, I'm big on unions. I'm all swagged up in Cominfront stuff. I brought some show and tell.
Show and tell stuff for us. Look at that.
Whenever there's a strike or a union organizing somewhere, I'm probably somewhere nearby.
Lovely. What do you think of the Cominfront strikes?
Well, what do I think of the Cominfront strikes? As you already say, right, there's multiple. I think it was a great fall in terms of the various sort of actions, the various strike days, the various mobilizations. And I mean, in September, for example, a huge demonstration, some estimates like up to 100,000 people in downtown Montreal. I've seen a few demonstrations in Montreal and a few large ones, and I think I've never seen one larger than that. You kept seeing people just streaming down from Park Avenue towards Sherbrooke, and it just wouldn't stop. And of course, all under the same branding, all under the same banner of the Cominfront, the recognizable sort of teal, I guess that is, right? Under the slogan of Nous d'une seule voix, us with one voice. And I think that sort of like really set the theme for and the mood for the rest of the fall. Like, people knew there are serious issues, there are serious attacks on the public sector, on education, on health in Quebec, and people were willing to show up and fight back, right? And I think that was, in that respect, to me, if nothing else, it felt like a great success, right? It felt like people were really there, people were really like understanding how all these various struggles are united, right? Because of course the Cominfront brings together teachers, nurses, more precarious employees from across the health and education sectors, government workers, and there was a general sense that like we're all in this together, right? It is one shared struggle, one common front that we're all fighting on. And that, I mean, I'm getting giddy just talking about that now. You can't help but get excited about that if you're in the union movement.
What a showing of people. It takes a lot of organization to get like any number of thousands of people into the street.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I think it's quite an incredible show from multiple different unions. So for those who don't know, the Common Front consists of the CSN, which you're a part of it with Dawson, the CSQ, the FDQ, and the APTS. But also participating in these strikes in Quebec over the last few months, you have the FAE and the FIQ, which respectively represents teachers and health and social service workers. It's said that this grouping, these six unions combined represent something like 10% of Quebec's workforce. I believe at the height of the strikes, we had something more than like 500, more than half a million people out in the striking. I remember those days because I'd be driving and doing errands, and I'm just like every like provincial government building I pass, people striking, and always you have to down the honks. People love that. I loved it. But now it's sort of wrapping up. There is no more general strike. You do not see the people out in the streets anymore. It's
there's sort of an agreement in principle that has been reached, right? So could you tell me a little bit more about what this kind of agreement looks like?
So it gets like fairly complicated fairly quickly, and that's kind of like usually where in these conversations you lose people, because you're starting to talk about pay percentages, inflation, and all these sort of like very small things that are relevant to different sectors within the common front, right? If we look at the six unions, right, there's various sort of like levels of escalation that we went through. Common front, for example, stopped short of an unlimited general strike, but had up to 420,000 of its members out on strike during a half-day action in, I believe, November, another three-day action in November, and a whole week from December 8th through 14th. And at the same time, after that first half-day strike, you have the FAE that goes out on an unlimited general strike. You have the FIQ that a little bit more closely coordinated with the Common Front and went on strike at the same dates, from what I remember, in order to increase the pressure on the government there. And right, and so what you're talking about, the sort of like agreement in principle, of course, like while these strikes are happening, the negotiations go on, or at least they're supposed to go on. There were various sort of messages that you would see in the media, Legault saying like, we're ready to negotiate if the unions want to. And the same day at a big demonstration leading through Montreal, at the end, the union organizers said, what the hell is that about? Like, we're here 24/7 every day of the week. It's the government that's refusing to speak to us while we're striking, right? So the negotiations go on throughout the strike period, FAE, FIQ, and the Common Front. And after Christmas, you have in the approaching the new year, the sort of agreement in principle, which is to say that our negotiating teams go to Quebec City right before Christmas to crunch out something with the government. The hope is on both sides that there is going to be a settlement, and that's what then turns into the agreement in principle in terms of a sort of general compromise that in terms of making painful cuts is like acceptable enough both for the government and for the Common Front or the other unions that they bring it to their membership for a vote, right? And that's currently what's going on with the FEE. That's currently what's going on with the Common Front. The membership is has now sort of been introduced to the agreement in principle. There's meetings, general assemblies. Dawson's, for example, was last Friday. And they kind of walk you through what are the concessions, what are the achievements of the agreement in principle, and they sort of like set the tone a little bit in terms of like whether this is an acceptable offer or not. And then the membership, of course, in a vote decides for themselves, and you sort of go through all the various unions that are part of, for example, FNEC, which is the subsection of the CSN that organizes CEGEP teachers, and then you go through the same sort of like sectoral sessions with each of the general assemblies across Quebec for the health sector, for the education sector. And the important differentiation there too is there's technically two agreements in principle, or actually more than two, because each of these individual organizations, the FNEC that organizes CEGEP teachers, has central demands that are negotiated by the Common Front that are the same for the nurses, the same for the teachers, the same for the low wage earners, right? For the precarious staff, for the support staff, for government workers organizing the Common Front. Exactly. That's usually what you hear in the media. Those are about wages. Those are about adjustment for inflation. That's negotiated at the central table for all of the unions organized in the Common Front. And then in addition to that, in the Common Front, you have the so-called sectoral tables, which deal more specifically with demands that are relevant to the CEGEP sector, but are not relevant for the nurses, right? Nurses have different kind of issues with their working conditions compared to teachers. Some are similar, right? A lot of them are along the lines of like, we need more money to create more positions in terms of support staff, right? That's a big ask, for example, for the FAE. They don't need a sectoral table because it's just them negotiating directly with the government. But one of their big asks is, we need more money to lighten the workload of teachers by creating more support staff to help out teachers, right? So stuff like that, a lot of other like more obscure stuff for the non-union members is about parental leave, about vacation days, about retirement. All of these are things where the government usually wants to make cuts, and then of course the union itself actually wants the opposite, right? They say like, well, why cut further something that's already been kind of like chopped away at for decades, right?
Right. Could you tell me a bit about the, I guess what you're seeing at Dawson, right? Since the vote was just this Friday, so what? How was the results? What was the, I guess, general? Were people happy with were people happy with the contract?
I mean, I can differentiate a little bit between sort of the membership. There were quite a few people that were speaking, not necessarily speaking out against the agreement, but voicing concern, voicing disagreement, including the mobilization officer who was sort of like everyone else speaking. Everyone sort of agreed, like, the executive did a great job. The CSN did a great job. The strikers from the other unions that we're associated with all did a great job. But a lot of people sort of like, while recognizing that and recognizing the achievements of the agreement, expressed concern about certain concessions that were made, especially at the central table. Two of the big ones were when we first went into the negotiations, we sort of voted on at our assemblies what are supposed to be the things that we really like were not budging on. Right. One of the big ones was the government kept asking for a 5-year contract. And that's something where the Common Front said unions in general, like they shy away from agreeing to these sort of longer contracts, because, of course, those have the risk that once you sign the collective agreement, you can't strike for the next 5 years. Right. Right. So that, especially if we're talking like a period like right now where inflation is fluctuating out of control and it's very hard to gauge, like, is it going to slow down? Is it going to pick up again? What's going to happen in the future? There, of course, it's like a serious concern that if you agree to a 5-year contract, you might end up shooting yourself in the foot if suddenly like inflation skyrockets and your gains, your achievements in terms of getting some acknowledgement of inflation over the last 3 years of the contract might get shot to pieces, right? There's some provisions for that in the agreement, which is why ultimately the Common Front unions said this is an acceptable offer we're going to bring to membership, but the risk remains of the 5-year contract, right? So that's one of the things at the central table. One of the other issues was that the Common Front said the main thing that we want is something that we gave up in the 1980s, which is adjustment for inflation. That was something that used to be part of the collective agreements and over time was sort of like given to the government as a concession, like, oh, okay, well, it looks like we don't really need it at the moment, so we'll let go of that. And of course, that's something that's very much regretted now, because now people wish, like, well, would have been great to have this in this situation, right? A lot of the issues along wage, for example, are that there's very little acknowledgement in the agreement in principle as it stands now from the government that inflation actually started to happen and started to affect salaries even before the contract ran out, right? We're actually still catching up on a lot of the sort of like loss in real purchasing power that the salaries have already gone through, right? So when the media, for example, talk about like, well, inflation is this and that much, projected this and that much, and these are the achievements of the collective, the agreement in principle for the new collective agreement, they're missing a little bit that this is something, the unions are dealing with something, a kind of wage loss that has already been going on for the last 2 years.
Right, at the end of the last contract, which I think I did like just April 2023, it's like because of inflation, it was already kind of like, I guess you're losing progress on on wages.
And there, so for that reason, for example, one of the elements of the agreement in principle is that the first year you're going to see a big increase, 6% increase, but that's actually not as big as it looks because it's kind of catching up for losses in earning power that were incurred over the last 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, fascinating. Can you talk a bit about the build-up to this, right? Because I think from what I heard, like contracts ran out. When contracts ran out, I guess, what was the move? Because I talked to Maria Mastorakos over at John Abbott, and she was talking about, like, back in April, back in the summer, the teachers there, not just the teachers, of course, the staff at John Abbott kind of knew they were in for a big fight because already, like, the cost of living crisis, inflation, everything was squeezing teachers much more. Having to transition from COVID kind of style teaching, everyone, like, including the teachers, including the students, were already kind of, like, there's this pressure put on them, right? And then for the government to have been stonewalling, from what I've heard, kind of, it just set the scene so that she was telling me people who were like teachers and staff who were usually sort of, I guess, temperate or like not too much of, didn't care too much about striking or doing these kinds of actions to get their kind of pay. A lot more people were activated by this,
yeah.
And I'm kind of curious what the the mood was at Dawson during the summer, like during the lead-ups to the conference for strikes?
Similar to what you're describing from John Abbott, and I guess like shout out to the John Abbott teachers and staff. Great mobilization at John Abbott. Very envious of like the level of like activation there. I mean, Dawson too, very happy with our union there and the mobilization. But John Abbott, I think, got like as close to unanimous endorsement of the strike mandate as you can get. 99.4%. I think, which like in their assembly is the equivalent of like one person saying like no thanks, and everyone else wholeheartedly endorsing. Right, so that's very impressive. You see something very similar at Dawson, right? There's a general sense that coming out of the pandemic, having dealt with that sort of stuff, and having been told, essentially, along with a lot of the other essential workers for years, that, hey, you're essential, and now to essentially, like, I mean, there's no more polite way of putting it, but essentially getting stonewalled by the government and getting repeated offers that are, like, the collective agreement equivalent of getting spit in the face, where the union asks for adjustment for inflation plus 9%, and the government says, how about just 9%, which is the equivalent of a 7% pay cut. Like, you can tell, you could already tell at the assemblies, at the coffee hours organized by the union to kind of make sure that everyone is in the know about the latest developments in negotiations or lack thereof, that people were, like, they cared about this, right? And there was an understanding, and of course, it's easy if you're sort of like on the front line of that, as a teacher, as a precarious teacher, like myself, for example. I'm largely teaching content classes. I don't always get contracts in CGEP. I have to apply for each individual contract at Concordia and McGill. And people like that, they know that, like, whenever the government says, like, we need to make some tough choices, that means tough choices for the people that are already at the bottom rung on these priority lists and the precarious stages of this work. And even for the people that are just doing the work, like, class sizes keep increasing. Like, even during my time in CGEP, I started teaching at Vanier, then Dawson in 2021. And, like, even during my time in CGEP, like, I feel like the classes keep getting just a notch bigger every semester, and just enough that you feel like it's noticeable, right? And of course, like, what that means is more students, fewer time that you can allot for each student, right? Same with the healthcare sector. Like, for nurses, for doctors, they know that, like, they can't really offer the services that they would like to offer simply because they can't keep up with the volume, right? And then, of course, to kind of, like, hear from the government, actually, we're not going to pay you more. We're not going to improve working conditions. In fact, we want you to further shoot your jobs to pieces by agreeing to distance education that is going to swallow up all the intellectual property of the teachers, put it up online from the college, and then simply phase them out, right? Or only hire them to grade, hire, like, three teachers as graders, where before that you had one full-time position for a teacher. Stuff like that, where people were increasingly seeing, like, their profession under attack, public services under attack, and increasingly, thanks to Common Front messaging, seeing that this is something that's not just happening in CGEP, but also happening in the healthcare sector, also happening to government employees, happening across the province, across the country, happening to grocery workers, right? Same situation there, much more precarious, much closer to the low wage earning bracket, and even more sort of like facing an uphill battle because they're not organized in these sort of large cooperatives. In fact, their unions are split into even smaller bits between various unions that kind of rely on pattern bargaining, which means they rely on one union making gains, and then they ask for the same thing. But it's, of course, a very different sort of like pressure that you can put on the employers compared to a common front that puts 500,000 workers on strike at the same time, right? And so there was a general like sense that people were increasingly seeing sort of like their profession under attack, their public services under attack, and making the connection. Right, and I think that is like one of the big successes of the Common Front, that it sort of really showed the workers that A, striking works, right? It gets direct action, gets the goods, and B, that this is part of a larger struggle, right? And there, if we're looking historically at where this whole idea of the Common Front comes from in Quebec, where this whole practice comes from, if we go all the way back, that's actually one of the first sort of like rationales, or the first sort of idea of the Common Front, that by bringing people together in the public sector in particular, you actually mobilize or have a chance to mobilize all of civil society, right? Because CEGEP teachers and healthcare, those two in particular, they affect everyone, right? If like you have tons of, like most people here in the studio will have a story of either them or someone they know going to the emergency room and waiting there for like 10 hours. I have a story of like going to the emergency room with with my partner and waiting there for 10 hours, right? So like that's like people know that there are issues.
Right.
And if the unions go on strike and specifically frame it in terms of we're not just asking for wages, but we're actually like we care about these services that we provide, but that we also receive, right? Then it becomes much more clear and much easier to mobilize not just them, but their families, not just them, but their students and the parents of their students, right? Not just them, but their patients and the relatives of the patients, right? Then suddenly you're not just talking about 500,000 people, 500,000 workers going on strike, but then you're suddenly talking about mobilizing like a significant segment of the Quebec population, right? If you're talking about teachers going on strike, as you said, right, you see the picket lines, people honking, you know, people picketing their workplaces. It's visible. And with that visibility, there's also an impact, right? It's visible, but there's also a heavy impact, like especially teaching. That means other workers that are dealing with their own issues in their own jobs, at their own workplaces, they suddenly have to deal with the fact that they have to deal with their kids, right? They have to figure out what to do with their kids. And that's, of course, something where the government always says, well, that's the teachers holding the students and the families hostage. But what people are realizing more and more, and you see this, for example, in surveys that sort of show that like a whopping 87% of the population are actually sort of seeing their public services under attack and are in solidarity between 70 and 80% of the population with the Common Front strikes, the FAE, the FIQ, right? They understand that actually it's not the teachers or the nurses holding their patients or their students hostage, but it's the government,
right?
And they've actually been holding them hostage for quite some time, and they use them very strategically during these negotiations that the government likes to say they negotiate in good faith, but I don't think it takes a lot of digging to kind of realize that actually they're very much not negotiating in good faith, right? They're stonewalling. They keep dragging out negotiations. They keep asking for revisions. They keep asking for things that they've already asked before. And that, of course, like stalls the negotiations, drags the whole process out, and then makes these strikes much more impactful because, of course, they've been creating this problem like for quite some time, right? Same with cuts. And, I mean, we live under an austerity government. This has been strategic. They've been chopping away at public services for ages, and this is what's come to a head with this negotiation, what's going to come to a head once again, even if the Common Front offer is accepted, right? And we'll actually continue to have this issue on the menu because it looks like the FAE, which is voting tomorrow, the final union that is going to be the tiebreaker in whether they agree or reject to their collective agreement, to their agreement in principle, it looks like they might actually vote against it, which would mean that then the question is again, well, what happens? What concessions is the government going to make, right? And we kind of stopped at a very similar level. Like there were similar concessions made to the FAE as to the Common Front in terms of pattern bargaining. And if now the Common Front accepts, but the FAE keeps continuing the struggle, then like we're in a period where it's going to be very interesting to see like how far the government can be pushed, right? Yes, yeah, yeah. I can also go back a little bit to I promise, a sort of historical perspective, right? I did like a show and tell, right? So this document in particular, the Le Deuxième Front by Marcel, let me look at the name, Marcel Pépin. This was a speech essentially given to CSN union members in the 1970s, in 1972, as part of that first strike. 50 years ago, 1972. And what that like title, Le Deuxième Front, represents is in the 1970s, the sort of realization that actually it's not just about the workers, It's about their living conditions. It's about their pay, but it's about their living conditions. It's about their working conditions. And it's about the living conditions of society as a whole. So the important contribution of Pepin here and the CSN, what they introduced to the Common Front struggle in 1972, when for the first time the predecessors of these various unions, CSN already existed in its current form, when they entered into that first Common Front, their rationale was, we're fighting for, in that case, a minimum wage, but we're also fighting for the public services. We're fighting for the whole of society. And especially the more militant unions like the CSN, like the CSQ, that had a socialist Marxist analysis of the situation, the CSN in particular, framed this as not just a struggle about working rights, not just a strike about improvements of working conditions and pay, but as an attempt to overturn the system, to actually change the entire economic organization of society.
So it's not just about working conditions. It's about using these
kinds of large strikes as a way to kind of like just improve society in general.
Exactly.
Like a leveraging tool for like the masses.
Yeah. At the end of the speech, Pepin says, we're trying to mobilize misery against misery, poverty against poverty, the exploited against exploitation, right? And I mean, that's very powerful, right? There you're saying like it's not just about the unions themselves and their membership, but it becomes almost a kind of like revolutionary understanding of unions as having the potential to be that sort of like vanguard of the working class, the most educated or not educated, the most trained in the struggle, that have the means to actually mobilize the entirety of society, right? And that's, I mean, it worked in the 1970s to the degree that even though it kind of fell apart and petered out, as you said before, right, they did eventually, 2 years later, get the minimum wage, right? They did they made certain achievements that became relatively permanent. Like the fact, for example, that every time there's a big negotiation in the public sector, you reconstitute the Common Front, right? Same this year. It's not an automatic thing. You have to make an effort. The unions have to agree to it every time. But this time again, it worked in 2015. They had the same sort of negotiation tactic, and they're doing it again now, right? Like with the Common Front that is constituted in 2022, I believe, negotiating with the government while the government is letting the contract expire, and then really mobilizing in the aftermath of that, right? And using a very sort of strategic collective messaging that kind of calls the government out on its bullshit. Like, for example, after offering no raise for inflation and only 9%, 7% pay cut essentially, what did they do next? They voted to adjust their own salaries in the assembly for inflation and then added a 30% wage increase, right? And that's something where like the Common Front is very good at sort of like turning to its members and saying like, what the hell? Like how do you square that circle between what they're giving themselves and what they're offering everyone else, right? And again, like that's something where I wish like through shows like this, through the article that I wrote for Jackman Magazine on the Common Front and its history, that there's more messaging out there that really kind of like for people in general connects these sort of things. That there's a reason why austerity is applied and a rationale of these governments, but it's not what they actually do. When they make cuts, it ends up going into their pockets and ends up going into the pockets of big companies, right, through the various sort of not back channels, but through the various modes in which that kind of money always happens to somehow end up in an XX bonus,
sure,
rather than in the public services that are cut, with the justification being, oh, we're trying to like save them, right? That's of course not what they're doing. They're trying to privatize. They're trying to privatize because that brings more money into private coffers, more public money actually, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a big thing that then the Common Front can come in and say like, well, we don't want that. Actually, we want more money in the public sector. We want less privatization because we want precisely to prevent some of these things that you see in their sort of hyper-capitalist versions in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Total privatization of the healthcare system, all these sort of things that you see in various other sectors of society. Like if you go to a veterinarian, for example, they keep increasing the prices not because the veterinarians want to, but because a lot of them are owned by like large companies from the United States that exploit the fact that veterinary medicine is entirely privatized, right? And then can use exactly that to make more of a profit while providing like the minimum of services that they have to provide, right? And what it does, as in the public sector, in any sort of like struggle over privatization, is it throws under the bus the workers and it throws under the bus the people receiving the services, right?
Thank you again for that. I want to try and get your thoughts on something, because you, in the last like, few minutes, you've been touching upon a lot of interesting things I want you to sort of expand on.
So before you talk about the general public support for these strikes here, right? I think, like you're saying, a lot of people understand the struggles teachers, public service workers are kind of going through, and I think that's why there's such a show of support for it this time around. You're saying something between 70% and 80%. I'm kind of curious what your perspective was at Dawson and how what the reception was like from students, parents. Let's just start there.
Yeah, our union in particular, we had a kind of like sort of they sent around a document that kind of did essentially like. I kind of did that with my students as a sort of like teaching exercise of, well, we're in English, we interpret texts, so let's interpret, for example, government messaging, right? That's actually a great exercise to sort of see like, what are they saying, right? What are they putting out in public? What gets reported? And what do they actually mean, right? When they say we need more flexibility in the public services, what do they mean? They mean more precariousness, more power for them as the employer, right? When they say we want more access to education, every teacher would agree to that. That's a great thing, right? But what does access to education mean to the government? It means privatizing. It means shifting to distance education, cutting back on teachers, because, of course, if you use distance education, you can use one teacher in a couple of graders where you otherwise would have to pay four. And like, I'm pulling these numbers out of the air, but like, sure, where you have to use like two or three teachers to teach these actual classes in person, right? You can cover 100 students in an online class if you add a couple of graders, whereas normally you would have 30, 40 people in a class, right? So those are the kind of things where like these are things that need to kind of be explained to people and even to the membership and to the students, right? So for example, I explained to my students, well, remember the worst stages of the pandemic where you were sitting at home depressed in front of your computer dealing with online classes. They want that, exactly, they want that permanently, right? And immediately you see sort of like a light bulb go on over their head because they're realizing like, oh, this is like, it's sure it's about wages and all this stuff and like my teacher is being maybe a little bit less stressed about making ends meet, but it actually like, there's a ripple effect. There are other ways in which I'm going to be affected by this, right? And I think that's something where in the future, over the next years, if the contract gets accepted, unions like the ones organized in the Common Front need to push a lot more of this messaging out in public, because the way it's reported in the media, there's not a lot of kind of, there's not a lot of ability of people to kind of like parse that kind of language that comes from the government, right?
Between the lines.
Exactly. The governments are very smart. The way that they frame it, they make it sound attractive, right?
Yes.
But if you look, for example, at big federal party platforms like the Conservative Party, there's a lot of people that will agree with them on various issues, and they will look at their program and say, oh, look, they have the little guy in mind because they want...
It's highly objectionable.
They want the right to work, right? And everybody will say, oh, right to work, that's great. Except, of course, that's what is in the United States, what they call laws that are essentially going to sabotage unions, prevent them from collecting membership dues directly from all members. And what that does is gradually chip away at the bargaining power of unions until you can privatize more, undermine their power more, right? And that's something that's very hard to kind of make visible in the public eye. And that, I think, is sort of like why I'm here and what people are trying to do in the Common Front, trying to kind of make everyone understand that we're kind of like in this for you, right?
Of
it's
course,
for us, but it's also like we're at the front line of where the government kind of attacks on these issues.
So I think there's something interesting about the press coverage around the Common Front strikes, because I think it received a decent amount of press coverage.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more detail in it that than I was used to for like any kind of labor journalism. I think partly, of course, due to just the gargantuan nature.
Yeah,
right?
The size.
Naturally,
yeah.
Everyone was kind of paying
attention. Can't not report on 500,000 people going on strike.
No,
right?
Exactly. But it's interesting because I still found it underreported.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I still found it kind of like didn't get the weight it deserved.
Yeah.
I think there's some. I want to talk about some of the press coverage around it and your thoughts on it, because I remember there's some articles really framing up, talking about how, like you were saying before, about how because the teachers are on strike, then now the parents are sort of responsible for their students, or for their children,
yeah,
right? Your students. And there's some articles that would frame this. I think I saw some in CBC about how, oh, you have like kind of these students who have, who need a little more like support, like students with disabilities. And now because teachers are on strike, they're sort of like left aside or cast,
yeah,
aside. And that was usually, that was kind of typically the framing that was used. I'm kind of interested in what you make of that kind of coverage of the strikes?
Yeah, I will say that as time went on, I saw at least, I forget, unfortunately, the name of the author, but I saw at least one commendable article in the CBC that actually tried to do what I did in my Jacobin piece, which also is published in People's Voice, which actually, as one of the sort of like another show and tell pieces here, which actually had a great coverage of the strike. You'll find a great sort of post-mortem of the strikes and assessment of the central agreements later on in the article here. Beautifully painted and highlighted by me and my obsessive nature.
Is there a color coding going on here?
Roughly, yes. Too much to go into now, but like I highlight main ideas in blue.
Main ideas in blue.
Yes, everything else is just sort of framing,
tips
right?
From the professor.
Yeah. But apart from that, like there was one commendable CBC article that tried to explore a little bit the history of the Common Front itself. But for the most part, what you get is sort of like, as you say, right? Like you get that one article that says, "Oh, they're on strike." And then you hear very little in between that and the strike wrapping up and maybe the next government offer coming in, right? And of course, what that does is it turns it into sound bites where like all you get on the news is, oh, they're on strike, oh, this union is on strike, and you get very little connection between these things, right? It makes it very hard to kind of like see the pattern. And I think that's sort of the main challenge here. And I think like, I'm not throwing journalists under the bus either, right?
Yeah,
you guys are doing a great job. You're trying to exactly push back against that. You're trying to identify those patterns. but the challenge there is oftentimes journalists themselves will not understand like how to look for these patterns. Same as the unionized workers oftentimes can't quite make that connection. And that's of course something where struggle is a school, right? Like seeing this play out through strikes, seeing this play out as a member of a large organization like the Common Front, it teaches you that there is actually a connection, right? It shows you if you show up to a demo with 100,000 people under the same banner, under the same slogan, we with one voice, it shows you you're not alone in this and you can suddenly make these connections that before that you weren't able to see. Even with that, like talking to other people on the picket line, you still hear a lot of this sort of like, oftentimes coming from the middle class in particular, this kind of rhetoric that based on their own material conditions says, oh, people are always asking for more money, you know, like times are tough, everyone has to make cuts. And that again, like it's an inability to really understand what's going on and what these unions are trying to do. And I think there it's really important to kind of get the word out, make these connections as you guys are trying to do, as I'm trying to do, as a lot of other people are trying to do.
As our listeners are doing very well.
As our listeners are doing, right? That is sort of like key in keeping the momentum going over the next 5 years, right? As I said, like one of the main concerns in accepting this agreement now is that if we agree to it for 5 years instead of, as is common, for three, then there are certain risks associated with that, right? What if inflation goes past the 1% that we gained as a sort of acknowledgement in each of the last 3 years, right? What then? We can't go on strike, we have to sit it out. So and even if it doesn't happen, the attacks on the CEGEP system, for example, on the healthcare system are going to continue, right? Now that that's wrapping up, Bill 14 is still affecting English institutions in particular, and I should say, like, I speak in English. I'm not an Anglophone. I'm from Germany originally. So English is not my first language. It's my second language, I guess. And then, like, add French, like, a couple of languages later. It's something that here is always framed in a sort of, like, way where it's sort of dismissed as, like, oh, it's a concern of, like, the West Island, of Westmount, a sort of, like, middle-class, upper-class concern over language. I hate that framing because who is going to be affected at English institutions first, for example? It's going to be students from an immigration background. It's going to be indigenous students. It's going to be teachers such as myself who are from a linguistic minority in Quebec, right? And who are at the bottom of the class list. If they push through further applications of Bill 101 in Quebec in the English CEGEP system, my job might still go away. I'm hoping that it doesn't, and so far it's looking good. But it's only looking good now because at Dawson, for example, the language departments have to bear the big brunt of this attack, right? And you're also obviously attacking French students who are going to these institutions because they want to improve their English, because they want to improve their job chances and all this stuff, right? And that's something where, for example, in the CEGEP sector in particular, there's still a lot of bad blood in the way that, or bad blood is maybe overstating it, but there are some concerns at the English institutions that a lot of the Francophone CEGEPs pushed through a vote that voted for an even stricter application of Bill 101 to the CEGEP sector, right? So some of these issues are going to continue, and they're going to continue over that five-year period, which is going to make it challenging to keep up the messaging, identify the patterns, and keep up the momentum that we, like, that we really had this fall and this winter with the FAE, with the FIQ, and with the Common Front.
You mentioned your article in Jacobin.
Yes.
So Jacobin magazine is a leftist space magazine out in the U.S. Very wide readership. I think they have a very large print run. I'm being told we have 10 minutes left. So this is good because we'll wrap this up. We have 15. No, last
five.
Oh my goodness. I can make this a shorter question. So I guess with your piece published in Jacobin, I'm kind of curious about, just on a more kind of like personal front, about your kind of views of labor in general. I guess I want to know what about the Common Front strikes did you feel was necessary? What motivated you to give, I guess, a perspective, your perspective on this to this large American audience? I think, yep. What did you want to impart on American readership about these strikes here in Quebec?
American readership and rest of Quebec, right? I republished it in People's Voice as well, which is a national publication in Canada. And the reason behind that and making it known to an American audience is, of course, Quebec, with all its contradictions and issues, stands out as really a hub of labor militancy in North America. And it has its own sort of path, right? This whole idea of the Common Front struggle is something that is very unique to Quebec and actually tries to mediate some of the issues that exist in the rest of Canada, that exist in the United States. In Canada, for example, as I said, with grocery workers, a lot of unions sort of like, or a lot of workplaces organized by different unions having a hard time kind of like organizing that struggle in a broader front through things like the Canadian Labor Congress, right? Same in the United States. You see the Teamsters going on strike, you see the UAW on strike, but what kind of changes could you affect in society if they actually went on strike together, right? So I think that's sort of really the big lesson of the Common Front strike, that if you mobilize large segments of the working population and through them reach and try to reach large segments of the population, you can affect a very different kind of change, right? Which makes the labor movement such a great vehicle for these things. I have my own reservations about business unionism. I used to be a proud member of the Industrial Workers of the World.
Do you want to explain quickly what business unionism is?
So business unionism is the kind of union like these unions that essentially, the critique inherent in the term business union is that you have to come to a compromise with your boss, right? And you have to sign an agreement that says next 5 years I can't strike, right? That's a kind of concession that more radical syndicalist parts of the labor movement like the Industrial Workers of the World reject, right? They say, why should we give up our right to strike if it's a right, right? Why sign that away? And that's an absolutely fair point that I frankly agree with. I'm not syndicalist in that sense, in that I'm not a member of the IWW anymore. I'm a member of the PCQ, the Parti Communiste du Québec. So I'm a little bit more sympathetic in the sense that I see these unions, these business unions, the big unions, the Common Front, as great vehicles for change. They have their limitations, they have their contradictions, but they are a great starting point if you're trying to kind of teach people that there are things to be won and there are ways to kind of protect what we have, right? And I think you see this in unions at the moment, for example, the way that a lot of unions in Quebec and in Canada, in the United States as well, for example, express their support for a ceasefire in Gaza, that try to kind of like use the leverage that they have in society and the voice that they have to actually show that unions, they care about exploitation, they care about their membership, but they care about society at large, right? They care about human rights.
Right. Like
they care.
Marcel Pépin.
Yeah,
is kind of
exactly. They care about the whole thing. And at the same time, they're trying to, and that over time becomes, unions can be a vehicle to become a little bit better at that. Trying to identify these patterns and say, we deal with exploitation, we deal with capitalism, but we also deal with imperialism, which is to say, we deal with the stuff at home. We deal with it in the workplace, we deal with it in society, but we also deal with it in the world, right?
Incredible. I have a few more questions for you, but
next time.
Not enough time. Well, Felix, thank you very much for coming.
It was a pleasure.
On.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. That'll be all for today's main segment. Stay tuned for Hello Goodbye Lines with Savannah Craig. Hello Goodbye Line with Savannah Craig. How are you doing, Savannah?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you, Calden?
I'm doing excellent. That water was great.
Yeah, you were extra thirsty,
huh?
Oh,
my God. You know, let me just go for another. I'm all right. what do you have for us today, Savannah?
Yeah, I'm here to talk about forms of disruptive protests.
Disruptive protests. Okay, gotcha.
Yes. So disruptive protests have been used all over the world. You know, Montreal is such a active city. All the time I've lived in Montreal, I've seen many different forms of disruptive protests. But I think in the last few months with protests for Palestine, I've seen the amount of disruptive protests at an elevated rate. So I just wanted to talk about forms of disruptive protests that I've seen, as well as share opinions from activists on what they think of disruptive protesting.
Sure.
Yeah, so I have a few examples to talk about. I mean, in the last few months, you know, I've seen examples of people blocking traffic, you know, protests inside malls and stores that normalized ties with Israel or fund Israel's army. I've seen protests out of the offices of members of parliament, you know, even politicians' homes, outside of their homes, as well as activists, you know, coming up to politicians face to face and, you know, pushing them to call for a ceasefire or asking why they're not doing more while they're supporting Israel, kind of, you know, putting them on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also been some really creative forms of disruptive protest that I have not seen before. One that took place on December 11th in downtown Montreal, it was called a die-in. This was at Zim offices. Zim is an Israeli shipping company, and some of their shipments include military exports used by the Israeli army, you know, used against Palestinians. And essentially what a die-in is and was at this specific demonstration is people laid outside the Zim offices and essentially tried to emulate, you know, Palestinians that have been killed by these military exports that Zim is shipping.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was chanting going on in this kind of disruptive form, but I think it's just kind of trying to get a sense of, you know, I guess have like a reaction,
mm-hmm.
essentially. Yeah. There's also been ones that some people have not been too happy about. I think disruptive protests, they do...
Disrupt things.
Yeah, they disrupt things, yeah.
They interrupt people's quotidian lives.
They do. They really do. And, you know, I've been doing coverage for the last few months, especially at these forms of disruptive protesting. And, yeah, people in the comments are not too happy. One that got some pretty interesting comments was on November 4th, Palestinian Youth Movement. They hosted a protest where they marched from Place des Arts to Centre Sud to the CBC offices. And essentially in this protest, they were calling out CBC's coverage, essentially not being critical enough of Israel. You know, CBC has a history of saying, you know, this many Israelis were killed, whereas this many Palestinians died, and it's not really, you know, pointing a finger at like who is doing the killing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't say the word Palestine in their, it's not in their style guide. And yeah, I think there's been a lot of critique over CBC's coverage over the last few years. Most notably in the May 2021 bombardment of Gaza, but especially much, much more recently. And, you know, protest organizers, they had essentially painted or tagged outside of the CBC entrance. It included statements like, justice for journalists killed in Gaza and call it genocide. Essentially, a lot of people in the comments were saying, you know, this is vandalism, these people are terrorists, and they should be deported back to Palestine.
Mm.
Yeah, some pretty intense comments. I've seen those comments before on other posts, but I think this one. I still get notifications on it to this day, and that was, you know, a few months ago. People were not too happy. I mean, you know, it is vandalism, but I think part of these disruptive protests is to offer a form of shock value. To make people react and to make them kind of think about what's happening, you know, what is driving these activists and people who participate in this march to, you know, react this way, to disrupt. You were there at that protest.
I was. It was a very large turnout. It was a nice long march from Place des Arts. It was quite the visual, I guess, was because they put on the walls, they put up names of some people who had been who had been murdered by Israel, and then also, of course, you had the main spectacle, I guess, which was this kind of like red paint that was supposed to simulate blood.
Yeah, it was. I think out of all the protests I've attended over the last few months, that's definitely one that sticks in my mind. I think, especially as a journalist, you know, calling out the state of journalism. And I think there was a lot of really other interesting parts of that protest. You know, there was, I remember some people at the front, they had essentially, they were holding almost like a, I don't know if I can call it like a replica of like children who have been killed in Gaza, and essentially like wrapped in white sheets with some blood on them, on it. And you know, it's, I remember speaking with a friend about this, and she was saying, you know, I didn't really like that. Like, I didn't like seeing it. But I think things like this, it's... It bothered her. It's kind of that shock value where people think of it of like, you know, yes, you could like look away from the news, but if you're, you know, doing groceries, running errands, whatever it is, you come by this protest, you know, seeing someone hold this fake baby, this child that was killed. It's, you know,
the image recalls like the corpse of a child, right? It's incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah, uncomfortable.
Discomforting, yeah.
And I think like the discomfort is maybe what people want, like the reaction they want people to feel to almost mobilize them to do something if they haven't already been doing something. And I think as what you said before, it's kind of to also disrupt normal parts of life. I think the CBC protest was a really good example of like kind of making a reaction, you know, the discomfort of like seeing these fake babies that were killed, or the discomfort of seeing CBC or like a building in general be vandalized. But there's also less discomfort in these other forms of protests, but maybe like more frustration. In a protest on November 16th, protesters blocked the Jacques Cartier Bridge for 2 hours during rush hour. This is the most popular commuter bridge in Montreal. So, you know, people were prevented from going to work, from wherever they needed to go. And it's almost just a lot of what I've been hearing from activists is, you know, we can't continue to live a normal life while genocide is happening in Palestine, and we can't, you know, continue to contribute to the economy in the same way, especially an economy that does support Israel. So we have to disrupt by any means.
There's something that's interesting about, I guess, the two different forms of disruption you're looking at. Because it sounds like there's one form of disruption, which is like disrupting the image of something, disrupting like something's like status or kind of, let's go with like status, like image, right? You have like the idea of the CBC as this kind of crown corporation. It's supposed to be this really, this crown jewel of the Canadian like government, the Canadian state, that has this kind of large media apparatus, right? And the idea is, of course, that, you know, we have this thing that we're proud of, this thing is state funded, and it's supposed to be reporting on things so objectively, but we've had our conversations about what that kind of means, right? And so I guess the way I see those that kind of disruption at the CBC in comparison to the bridge one, because the bridge one is a very clear disrupting kind of like the flow of, let's say, like workers, laborers in the Montreal area, a lot of which come from like suburbs from where I'm from in Longueuil. And you have this flow of people, and that's interrupted. And this is not the first bridge block we've had in Montreal. There's also bridge blocks during the student strikes. There are bridge blocks, of course, during the Oka crisis by Kanyekeha in Kanawage. And I think there's always some kind of like hesitation to have with it, with the kind of interrupting life for regular people. That to me seems like it's not quite like these people aren't quite the ones who have the power to change things, right? I think not that they have no power at all, of course. And I understand the need to kind of just disrupt, like you're saying, by any means necessary, disrupt the flow of like day-to-day life. Because clearly in the day-to-day life of like people in Montreal, I think the concern of these pro-Palestine activists is that the concern for Palestine is just not present in day-to-day life. And that's something I guess that they're trying to like either shock people through, or they're just trying to activate people into caring, right? I think that's something that the CBC one kind of does. But anyways, like I was saying, you have one of them which directly kind of physically disrupts whether like economic flow or like by stopping workers from going to work. And then you have this other one which kind of disrupts public image, right, of people. And especially by attaching to CBC these images of like blood, these things that are like so far from, because like, I don't know if you've seen that building. I mean, you have seen that building. I don't know if our viewers have seen the building. This is like the a newer like development. They're in a new building now compared to where they were like in the big tower. It's like very clean, designed by Broccolini. It's like glass and everything. It's very sleek, right? And then now here we are in front of it, and there's just like this kind of street theater where there's like blood. There's kind of these, what would you call them, replicas, right, of like children's corpses, right? And it's such a shock to the brain. And people, like you're saying, your friend was like made uncomfortable by that, right? And I guess part of that strategy is they're just trying to bring these images into other people's common lives who might have otherwise kind of tried to step back from it. But I have my own kind of thoughts on those kinds of tactics, but that's who am I to talk too much about that?
No, I mean, it's hard to say because there could be such different reactions where, you know, someone, say, who's stuck in this lane of traffic for 2 hours is really thinking like, oh my gosh, yeah, this is terrible. I should do something. I'm not doing something. Or someone else who, you know, is also sitting in this lane of traffic thinking of, this is so annoying. How could they do this to me? I'm pissed. I'm pissed at these people. I'm pissed at this movement.
It's like a personal, they take it personally. It's a personal slight. They've interrupted my day. Why should I even care about their thing?
Yeah. So it's a bit of a risk. I think something else I noticed that comes from this is attention. I mean, there's not a good amount of coverage on these protests, and you know, a lot of mainstream media that do cover these protests, they're not really accurate about the number of participants. I've seen it happen multiple times where they do, you know, relay like there's, you know, 1,000 people, a few thousand people, but there's like actually like tens of thousands of people at the protests they were covering. So I think it's, you know, trying to get this reaction, not just from people who are affected, but, you know, to get the media there. And it's like them talking about, you know, not only are these lanes of traffic blocked, but, you know, this is why they're blocked. Because it's so hard for activists to, I think, kind of get attention towards this movement. I mean, like, I go almost every weekend to these protests, and I always keep an eye out for what journalists are there, but I don't see a big presence of, you know, like large media outlets there each time, maybe once in a while.
It's an interesting thing, I think, as well, to only, well, not to only, but like to have this goal of getting media attention. It's like the more, there's this like logic that it's like the more media attention you get, the more likely it is to get support for like your cause, right? Which isn't, I do not believe that is kind of like something that's so proportional. Mm-hmm. And that's why I do believe that there is quite a bit of energy, organizing energy, that is wasted on trying to get this media attention by doing these media stunts, right? Like, I think to go to CBC, to have this kind of thing of blood, to have these like props that are supposed to evoke children's bodies, and then even to block a bridge, there is like, of course, the bridge block, I do think, is a little more like tangible of a disruption. But of course, it is obviously like this thing to like, you're doing these escalating stunts to try to get more media attention in the hopes that like this starts to change people's minds. But like you're saying, it's like if they are not already like on board, right? So it's like, I feel like the people who would care would already be a part, like, whatever, like they're already supportive, right? So like how, I feel like you're going for like less and less gains by trying these kinds of stunts and interrupting people's days. But that's just, it's just pure hypothesis, at least on my part.
Mm-hmm. I guess in your experience, when you have conversations with people around you, like what do you think is like the general take on these disruptive forms of protesting?
I feel like the people I've spoken to, like other organizers, it's like, I think it's always good to have these kinds of muscles exercised. And when I talk about muscles, like organizing muscles, so not just like, I'm not talking about the specific action, but it's good practice for the organization, for these activists, for these organizers, to be like, okay, in 2 weeks we need to do something. What is it? And then what I think it's good for is all the behind the scenes that's happening to it, right? Everything that's like, you're mobilizing people, you're getting people out to this location, stuff like that, which I think is an important thing to continuously keep warm, I think, for a movement. But then, like, it's a question of actions, I think. I'm never too supportive of the kind of, like, blocking things for civil society, because I don't think the gains are big enough for whatever loss of, like, public appeal, right? Because I think the first time I really thought about this was, like, there was this Extinction Rebellion, which is this, like, environmental activist group. I think they're based out in London. They have, like, chapters all across the world. I think they're funded by Richard Branson. I could be wrong, so don't quote me on that. But I saw this action where they did a sort of... They did a disruption at a London Underground station. So it was some Extinction Rebellion activists jumped on top of the Underground, which is, like, their metro, and they prevented it from leaving. And, of course, in a similar way to the bridge blockade, they stopped people from going to work and not. But, like, I think, like, if their goal was to, like, cause a scene... to get attention, they did that. But then now, if their goal is to gain public support, if their goal is to like even like communicate to people who they're like disrupting and try to convert them to the cause, I think it was an absolute failure. Because like if we think about, I mean, on the broad level, when I think about like, oh, these the people whose lives should be disrupted for environmental causes, the people taking the subway is not like really like the first person I think of mind of, you know. It's like, that's like, it's like, it's like being an environmental activist and trying to bother people who like are biking, you know. It's like there's something about it that I feel is not strategic. It's not like pointed. And I think part of that I brought, and I could say this, I think I will say this about these kinds of like bridge blockade protests too, is I think there's this thing where it's like, who's my audience here? Who am I trying to convince? And a lot of times these people, and I've participated, right, in kind of let's say activist organizations, especially with like Tibetan like causes, where like we're thinking about our audience. We're not trying to speak to a specific subsection. We're trying to speak to all of society, right? We're trying to speak to as many people as possible, and that's why you might go for these stunts that try to get attention. Just like the idea is like, if we get attention, then surely we could translate some of that attention into like support for our cause. But I think the what you lose in that, I don't know why I did that. What you lose in that is something more pointed, something more more fruitful, I would say, because you're trying to go for these big actions and you do big actions and you get some attention for it, but then you're losing kind of like support. There's something about it that I think is disconnected, because it's this thing of like a thing about it's us trying to talk to all of Montreal, all of Canada, right? And like, oh, how do we do that? Well, we talk about, let's try and interrupt where all of Canada or like large parts of Montreal is kind of like go through, right? These checkpoints like the bridge or stuff like that. And I think there's something about that I don't think translates into what people think it translates into. I don't think those kinds of actions does really give any kind of net positive, aside from, I think, being a useful tool for organizers to keep their organizing kind of warm. If there's blockades, I think what is most effective, at least in terms of like effort, thing blockaded to what you can gain, like where can you get a lot of, I always think in terms of leverage, and I don't think you can get much leverage from blocking a bridge, or not one bridge. No, you need to block many bridges, or it needs to be like kind of on like a sort of synchronized collective effort, and I don't think that is quite I've seen that yet. I think that the best example of a synchronized effort was like, I guess the MP sit-ins, where you had most like pro-Palestine organizers across Canada sitting in at different MPs' offices across the country. I think that kind of, I think the organizing that gets to warm the muscles of having it synchronized in time, I think is very useful. Other than that, I'm not sure. You're saying that they're able to, there's some organizers in the States who are able to get some concessions from a senator, I believe, with that kind of disruption.
That was pretty interesting. So first I'll bring up like the local example. Melanie Joly, she's the Foreign Affairs Minister of Canada. On January 13th, Independent Jewish Voices, the Montreal chapter, they hosted a protest outside of her home. Not like at her doorstep. I think I wasn't there, but
I think they have to be in the street. They just can't be on her like lawn or something.
Exactly. I'm not sure if they identified like which home was her, but I think it's hers. But I think it's like, you know, generating enough noise to like annoy her, to make a scene. Mm-hmm. They did that early in the morning. I believe it started at 10 a.m. that Saturday. And I had seen, my friend actually sent me this, a similar situation in the States, in Maryland, with Senator Chris Van Holden, where 2 days in a row, activists went in the early hours of the morning outside of his home and had, megaphones, speakers. They were playing music, they were chanting, calling him out, you know, saying, like, good morning, wake up, like, we're here, call for a ceasefire. And then, you know, this TikTok video, it had just had documentation of both days. And after the first day, after both days, actually, they were like, okay, see you tomorrow morning. Like, it was this very committed, like, we're going to show up every single morning to wake you up, to piss you off until you call for a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the video, it showed Van Holden on the news calling for a ceasefire. And this was the afternoon of the second day that they held these protests. So I think there is something to be said about, you know, calling people out publicly, but also, you know, affecting their daily life, because, you know, I wouldn't love to be woken up by a megaphone outside my door.
Of course.
That's like you're being like, I don't want to use the word like personally targeted, but like, you know, personally identified.
I guess the way I think about that is you have, like, because you're a public official, because you're a public representative, there are official channels, right, for people to get to you to kind of voice their concerns. Usually that's like emails, you set up meetings, you kind of try and get a conference with them attending or something. And I think this kind of action where you show up outside their house, it's, you're trying to get to them outside these main channels of like the official channels of how you should contact them, how you should air your grievances. Instead, you have people here at their private home. I think I saw some NDP MPs, I think, complaining about, not complaining, but I guess showing concern about using that kind of tactic about being outside Melanie Joly's house. I don't know. I think, what do you make of that? Do you think people should be bothering people in their private residences?
So I think for me, the line is that I, like, as a public figure, you have to be careful about your safety.
Of course.
I think the line would be crossed if it's like, this is her exact home, this is the number of her address. Like, I think that's risky, where it's like, there could be people who, you know, are maybe dangerous.
Like with the Melanie Joly protests, it's like, even if they're not outside her exact home, like, their location does narrow it down, right?
Yeah, people have an idea. It's so hard to say, because, I mean, like, when I reach out to Melanie Joly's office for a comment on, you know, coverage that I've done where people are calling her out, I never get a response. I get the same email that people who are contacting her, you know, calling for her to do some form of tangible action to help people in Gaza, which is an email essentially saying, you know, an automated email saying, we are receiving like a higher volume than normal of emails, like, we will do what we can to get back to you. I have never actually received like a non-automated response.
Maybe she's watching.
I'm waiting for my email, Melanie. So I think it's the same thing with, you know, when people make phone calls. I think I have called her office as well for a comment. In October, I like the voicemail box was full. Couldn't even leave a voicemail. Recently, I called a few weeks ago. I've been able to leave a voicemail. I don't think I received any sort of like, you know, special, you know, message that, you know, they're receiving like a high volume of calls or anything like that. But I'm sure that they are. Mm-hmm. Just given the fact that people still call, you know, encourage activists to continue to call her office as they share her phone number. So I think that this is kind of like taking a step up. Well, it's like, okay, you can look away from this phone call, you can look away from this email, but you can't look away from us here.
Right, and I physically think, if we're like around your house.
Yeah, and it's like making her life so uncomfortable that, I mean, she doesn't even, with this, she wouldn't even experience a fraction of the discomfort people are experiencing in Gaza, but it's, you know, really trying to apply pressure. Like I've not seen a Trudeau action in person. Actually, the other week I was at one outside of the Fairmont Hotel in downtown Montreal. I didn't see Trudeau myself, but people are outside, you know, banging pots and pans, chanting. But in the videos I've seen online where activists do call out Trudeau, you know, he's heavily guarded. You know, there was even a situation in Vancouver, I think in December, where he was at dinner with someone, I'm not sure who, but, you know, people like entered the restaurant and were pushing for him to call for like a real ceasefire and to actually do something. So I think it is like an interesting tactic. I mean, it's hard to say because I agree with your point. Like, it is this tricky line where people know where you live and you don't know if someone's going to, you know, just disrupt or they're really going to like cross the line and maybe like wait outside the area, like wait to see her, you know, maybe her kids could be there. Like, things like that, you don't know. Thankfully, I've not heard any reports of kind of, you know, like dangerous forms of protesting. I think that it's all just been, you know, making noise and trying to frustrate them, not compromise their safety.
When you say dangerous, it's just something that might put them in harm's way?
Yeah, or their family. Sure. Yeah, just any... you know, harmful kind of action. But yeah, I've not seen this, but I mean, you know, it's a risk. Like, I spend a lot of time doing research on like, you know, threats and forms of harm that like female journalists experience for, you know, certain issues that they're critical on. So, I mean, you know, anyone who's kind of a public figure and saying things that people don't like, there's always that kind of risk. But yeah, you know, thankfully we've not seen that in this movement.
I guess some of the concern is like, I think some of the concern from some of the other MPs is like, you don't want this to become a normalized kind of tactic. Because of course you can have like, let's say you have pro-Palestinian people who are accosting MPs at their homes. But then like, what if you had like Freedom Convoy type people, right? And now they're kind of accosting like MPs at their homes, you know? It's like, is a tactic right because the people who use it are like the righteous ones, or is a tactic, should a tactic be avoided no matter of the kind of people who are trying to deploy it, right? Mm-hmm. Something I kind of think about. And I wonder how, you know, I wonder what the response would be to this kind of like tactic if it was like Freedom Convoy people doing it. And not to say that, like, of course, just like they're just, that's the first example of my mind, right? Because I think of like, usually in some broad sense, pro-Palestine activists and Freedom Convoy people aren't necessarily at the same demonstrations, except of course at the Million March for Family ones. Anyways, that can be another thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good example to bring up because I do remember there was this case at the Freedom Convoy where, you know, police were on horses, and I think there was one person that got like trampled by a horse, or there was some form of like violence that the police officer was using against the activist. And I remember speaking to someone and they were like, well, they have to stop them. But it's like, what if, you know, there was an environmental protest,
right,
and
yeah.
cops were using brutality, you know, horses.
Should we stop them because they don't, like, we don't share the same pods? Should we stop them because they're employing, like, dangerous kind of, like, tactics?
Yeah. So I think it's
an important question.
It is an important question. I mean, like, we do have the right to protest, to free speech in Canada.
Free speech.
So I think it's like there are definitely movements out there that I like question, I disagree with, but I think, you know, I can't stop them from being out there. Like,
of course,
police shouldn't use forms of violence to stop them. I think when I see those forms of protesting, it just means like we need to have like better education. I think especially around the 1 million march for children. I think, like, you know, we were both at this protest in late September, October.
Somewhere down. It was fall.
Yeah.
Nice sunny day.
Yeah. It was a bit cold.
Yep, I had my jacket on.
I did not. And yeah, I think like some people we were speaking, you and I had both spoken with, like, we noticed that they didn't really understand fully what was going on. They didn't have the right facts. Like, they were so concerned about the promotion of, like, you know, having sex, whereas you and I were like, you know, in our sex education as a kid, like, we learned abstinence is like 100% the most like foolproof method. And I think that this person we were speaking to kind of had that like, oh, moment of they didn't know. And yeah, it's like, well, you know, maybe read a little more before you're like.
Maybe not just going with the flow.
Yeah.
Assuming things.
Yeah.
What else do you have? What other examples do you have of disruptive protests to continue that conversation?
I mean, maybe I'm interested in your reaction on this one, because I think it's a form of protesting that, like, you critiqued, but you also supported. so this
is an enigma.
It was on November 22nd. Activists had blocked 6 lanes of traffic to the entrance of Lockheed Martin and Bombardier, which essentially, you know, these companies produce many things, one of many which are manufacturing weapons, which some are exported to Israel and, you know, used against Palestinians. This was during the time of the humanitarian pause, brief humanitarian pause, where activists were essentially saying the pause wasn't enough. So, you know, they're blocking kind of this mode of manufacturing for these two companies. But, you know, at the same time, you know, 6 lanes of traffic at 7 a.m. are also preventing people from getting to work. So
they blocked the 6 lanes of traffic that lead to?
Yeah, essentially the entrance. So, like, trucks.
Only the entrance, or?
Not only the entrance, but it was, like, in the way. So if a truck wanted to, you know, leave or get into Lockheed Martin or Bombardier, like, they couldn't because of this blockade, but also people who were...
work beside them?
Yeah, or just, you know, had to pass by, like, they couldn't either.
Okay, nice. So, yeah, so I think there is something to critique there, where I think I still... My critique of the bridge one still holds, but this one is much more precise. This one is a much more precise blockade. There's very... like, there's clearly, like, these two companies whose operations they're trying to disrupt. Mm-hmm. That is, like, I think that is... to me, that is, like... What I love about that kind of protest is because, let's say, if people hear about it, then immediately you have they learn about whatever the cause is, the people organizing it, but also you do now you have, like, sort of like, not necessarily antagonists, but now you see who the activists are pointing at, right? Because, like, if you're at the bridge, you're stopping things, you don't really have the, like, you're like the antagonist or the person they're trying to whatever, like, disrupt is just what, like, Montrealers, all of Canada. For this one, it's like clearly, like, these are the companies that are kind of responsible, right? I think what I enjoy about that, there's a much more clearer kind of finger pointed at people who they are accusing of feeding into this genocide. Of there's just a clearer kind of, like, picture being painted of, like, there's this happening in Palestine, and these are companies we believe are responsible for it, and that's why we're here trying to interrupt their operations. Because mm-hmm. on that level, again, still, it's nonviolent. It is using this kind of form of disruption, this economic disruption, that's not just trying to, like, where, like, it's not like a, what's the term? It's not like it's trying to spread out throughout, like, the city. It's very pointed toward these companies. And that's why I think it's, like, one of the more kind of, like, I would think, like, just, like, on like, a holistic level, I think it checks off a lot of things that I think is good for a protest. Of course, there are some people in the area who will be bothered, I think, on a much, much smaller scale than, like, if you blocked a bridge, you know? And it's not to say that bridge blockade shouldn't happen, but it's just, I think there is a sort of, like, when, at least in my terms, in my own terms, I think the ones where you get to actually point your finger at a company or an organization you think is responsible, and you get to leverage that against them, that I think is much more fruitful, much more of a fruitful action.
Yeah, there no, very, very well said point. There was another form of protest as well that I've been noticing. It's emerged more recently, especially during the holidays, but more notably, I think, in like late November, December, I started seeing this pop up more, is protests in malls and stores themselves.
Yes.
I think this really kind of gained momentum after Zara, which is like a clothing brand, they released this campaign, which was essentially like an involved... I wish I had a photo. It was essentially like involving like
a photo shoot they had, right?
Yeah,
like an editorial. Yeah, I remember this. It was an editorial they did, and it was sort of like their models. And in the backdrop was what kind of evoked the image of rubble, as well as kind of bodies wrapped in like plastic or like some kind of white sheet.
Yeah, like sheets, white sheets. And I think this really shocked people because it, like, you know, we've been seeing these images come out of Gaza where it's like just bodies upon bodies, like wrapped in these white sheets, and it's almost like there's too many bodies to have like a proper individual burial where people are just essentially put in this mass grave. And, you know, even like what I brought up earlier, the protests, the kind of, you know, fake child like wrapped in sheets was to bring attention to this. And it almost seemed like Zara was mocking this. And they had come out and said, you know, we put this campaign together in early July, like it, you know, it was before all this happened, but they still released it at this time and, you know, had multiple people involved where they're not like, you know, maybe we should scrap
this
campaign.
Right,
yeah.
Of course.
And it's like, for sure, they probably put a lot of like time and effort and money into it, but like it's, you know,
they're a big company. They got all those things in spades.
For sure. So in lots of places, but especially Montreal, activists had actually like gone into the store and started protesting, you know, clapping, going outside. Even the store on St. Catherine in downtown Montreal, people had like tagged the outside of Zara. So it's reminding people, you know, even though they don't have like a role in funding Israel, they're still like normalizing these images and almost like mocking what's happening in Gaza through this campaign. So it's like, don't give this store your money. This has also happened most notably in Montreal and Toronto as well, for Chapters Indigo. Their CEO, Heather Reisman? I'll let you read that.
Heather Reisman. That's my guess.
Thank you.
If it's wrong, my bad.
She's the CEO of Chapters. She's also the CEO of the HESEG Foundation, which supports Israel and its military, which, you know, are both complicit in the oppression and displacement of Palestinians. So, you know, people have like put up posters outside of Indigo. People essentially like have gone in and like chanted, clapped, like, you know, a form of disruptive protesting. And this is just reminding, you know, shoppers, like, don't shop here because your money is going towards someone who funds Israel and its army.
Yeah, I think in Toronto specifically, they got a lot of those activists got booked by the cops for that vandalism, which is like on like a level that was never ever before kind of deployed for vandalism, like the charge of vandalism.
No, it was like people, these activists, they had their homes broken into by police, like unannounced. It had really been framed as, you know, this was like an anti-Semitic action,
right?
Because Heather herself is Jewish, and there was a lot of pushback from activists saying, you know, we're not being anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitic. We're not calling Heather out because she's Jewish. We're calling her out because
her support of like a state and of course the military. I mean, I think this ties into like the discussions we've had prior about like the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, right? Where I think you see it being deployed in this case in Toronto, which is like far from us here in Montreal, but I think it's still useful because police here in Montreal still try to like, they kind of flirt with the idea of like, including like pro-Palestinian posturing in terms of like a sort of like a hate crime kind of vandalism, where like the IRGA states like you can't really like it tries to pin this sort of criticism of Israel and Israeli kind of the Israeli state and their practices as a sort of broader like criticism of Jewish peoples, right? Which is, I think, many times we've had many guests who have stated that it's not kind of the distinction that should be made. There's a clear distinction between a peoples and then the actions of a state. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to hear about that in Toronto. I don't know. I think there's also these protests. They're happening in, you're saying, November and December. I think you're talking about this kind of Zara ad campaign that they're reacting to. But I think there's also the other side of some organizers I've seen, I've spoken to, I've talked about just trying to interrupt. Like, we're talking about, like, the day-to-day goings-on of, like, Montreal. And I think during November, December, of course, people are Christmas shopping, right? They're doing their holiday shopping. And I think there's something that people found, something that these activists found. And I think with good measure, sort of like, I don't know if repulsive is the word, but like bothersome about how people are just going about their day, going about their like kind of like consumer habits, about like, oh, now it's time to go spend Christmas here. Meanwhile, like I feel like it's always it's like you guys, there's this privilege of being able to spend Christmas. There's this privilege of being able to be so removed, right, mm-hmm. from what's happening in like Palestine, that I believe this action, just like the other ones we mentioned, tries to take people out of that bubble that they exist in, right? They exist in that bubble because of the distance they have from the violence. They exist in this bubble because of the, perhaps even like the way that they might not read the news about it. And so I guess these attempts are sort of trying to burst that bubble, right? You can't just, the idea is, no, you can't just shop here. Mm-hmm. You can't just have your day. You go to Zara or you buy like clothes that are made by this fast fashion company that sort of exploits people overseas. You can't do that because of this thing that's happening. We want you to be paying attention to that. You can't have your kind of like polite little life, you know. Mm-hmm. Whether or not I agree with that, I don't know, but I understand the intentions behind it. I understand the timing of it specifically with I think they had some Boxing Day actions they planned as well. And that's sort of the intentions I see there. And I can kind of understand it. But this, I think, in comparison to the Lockheed Martin and Bombardier stuff, now this one, in a similar fashion to the bridge protest, goes back to trying to disrupt. Like, you have, like, the Lockheed Martin and Bombardier protests, those are trying, like, we're using this language of disruption, those are trying to disrupt, like, corporate operations. The bridge one, and I would say these mall ones to a certain extent, is not trying to disrupt corporate operations, but just trying to disrupt, like, certain kind of, like, daily life for some people.
The TV's been disrupted.
Yeah, TV just went on and off. That disrupted me. But yeah, so I think there's something about that, which I understand, of course. I think that this kind of action seems much more to me about just trying to raise awareness, trying to make sure that people don't feel too comfortable being so far from this violence.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the kind of actions around the holiday times were really interesting because, you know, we were seeing in Bethlehem, like, churches calling for people not, or specifically saying in Palestine, you know, we are not celebrating Christmas this year mm-hmm. because our people are experiencing a genocide right now. There's mm-hmm. nothing to celebrate about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here in the West, like, Christmas has become so detached from what it really is. I mean, like, my family, we celebrate Christmas. We are not Christian, but it's just kind of this time of like, you know, let's get together, let's eat, let's drink, like, let's just, you know, be thankful we're together. And for sure there's like this capitalist element to it where we are like spending money on each other, buying gifts. But I think like in the West, it's so amplified that there's such a large focus on consumerism. You know, we have Black Friday. We have endless emails coming into our inboxes about all these sales, you know, shop here, shop here. But it's like this holiday is to celebrate the birth of Jesus. And so many people have lost, you know, touch from these religious values. And so many Christians around the world were celebrating Christmas when, you know, Jesus, who was Palestinian, you know, he, like, his own people are saying, you know, don't celebrate Christmas. There's right. nothing to celebrate over. And I think that these were such, you know, interesting forms of protests, specifically, you know, these demonstrations in stores and malls, because it's reminding people, as you said, like, of course, disrupting normal parts of your lives, but I think really making people consider, you know, where is my money going? And I've had so many conversations with people, you know, when I go out and shop, I see people too, like, they're shopping and they're on their phone and they're looking at this product and they're looking on their phone and they're trying to make sure that they're not purchasing a product that, you know, is an Israeli product, you know, upholds, you know, Israel's economy, because they don't want to participate in that. They don't want to fund an apartheid state. And, you know, this is something that was so huge, you know, with South African products, you know, mass boycotts going on. And, you know, they're effective. Like, we do have power in our pockets where our money goes. Pen is moving again. What's going on?
I think this is like a huge conversation. I think this is something I disagree with, or I have very I hold reservations about. Of course, I support the intentions behind this, like, unequivocally, of course. But I think there's like this important distinction. Like, I think even before, when you talk about, like, capitalism being this thing about, like, shopping and getting gifts, I think it's like it is that, but it's also so much more than that, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just like the act of, like, buying something, because, like, people were buying things, trading things, gifting things long before capitalism existed, right? Capitalism is this system of that decides who gets, like, who makes what, and how the surplus of that, or how the money of that, is, like, divvied out, right? Like, you have, like, the laborers who are going to make this for us. We're going to exploit them. You're going to give them wages less than they would make if they obviously controlled the means of their own kind of the productions. Like, that's what, like, Marx says about that. But I think even to go upon the thing about boycotts or that kind of ethical consumerism, ethical consumption, there's something about that's kind of always, like, bothered me. My own views on it, at least, are that, like, it takes such, like, I don't know if I really believe in these things that are, like, individual consumption habits being changed, or using individual consumption habits to try to, like, affect, like, a greater good. Because, of course, I think there's something about it that, which I understand, right? Like, if you're telling me that, like, let's say, like, this cup, maybe not the CUTV cup, like, if you're telling me that this pen was made in, like, Nepal and, like, a million children died to make this pen, I'd be like, I don't want to buy that kind of pen, you know, easily. I want to remove myself from that kind of equation. But just removing myself from that equation doesn't mean this pen doesn't get made, right? It doesn't mean that exploitation doesn't continue. Of course, there is the idea that with our pockets, right? Because there's a profit being made off of this pen. And there's the hope that if enough people sort of stop buying this hypothetical, it's a completely hypothetical pen, I wanted to say. If people stop...
Who is this pen? Just name the company.
The things I did to get this pen. No, I have this hypothetical pen I'm holding. And let's say a million children died, right, in Nepal to make this pen. I don't want to buy this pen anymore. And by that way, I get to remove myself from whatever this these circuits of exploitation. That doesn't mean that exploitation doesn't happen, right? There is still the exploitation is going to happen. I think the idea with these kinds of consumer boycotts is that enough people, like, let's say, maybe I can convince everyone in this room not to buy the children killing pen. You still have those.
Should not be laughing.
I mean, I understand why you're laughing, because it's such a ridiculous, like, yeah, idea that this, yeah, pen. But I mean, it's not too far from, like, the actual existing sort of systems. Because I think, so my issue with, or as my reservation, it's not an issue, my reservation with these kinds of boycotts, because I think as part of, like I was saying before, like, sort of Tibetan advocacy stuff, they tried these groups, these Tibetan advocacy groups were like, all right, like, we want to try to, like, advocate for Tibet. In a way that, like, is gonna, like, where, like, we want to try and leverage for Tibet, and they're like, we're gonna boycott made in China things. How do you think that went?
Not well.
Not well at all. Because, of course, because there's the idea of, like, China has this huge, massive output since, like, the 90s, since the globalization, since they became, like, the world's factory, as people are saying. They have this huge amount of goods that is just, like being, like, just sent out everywhere, right? And so, in terms of, like, proportion of leverage, we're like a drop in the bucket to, like, the actual people who are, like, buying the stuff. And of course, it's not to say that people who are buying into this stuff necessarily agree with the politics of China, or who, there's not, like, the act of buying a Chinese made good means that you're, like, kind of, like, signing a contract that's saying, like, I, Kong Danspa, endorse everything that is made in China, I endorse all of China's politics. And I think there's something about that that ties into this thing of, like, it's to me the kind of consumer boycotts, or the idea of changing your own consumer habits, which I think is amenable. I think it's commendable I think it's commendable. I think it's very noble. And I think there are ways that you can, like, improve, like, the world in, like, very, like, little minute ways, or at least in your own little bubble, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you're using, like, if you're living, like waste-free, vegan, I think there's a lot of ways that you remove yourself from these massive systems of exploitation. But I don't think that necessarily means that these systems of exploitation is going to stop. I think a lot of times they adjust for whatever kind of loss of capital they have, mm-hmm. whatever kind of loss of, like, sales they might have. Mm-hmm. There's different ways that they adjust. I think people maybe underestimate how these systems adjust and how they, like, try to make up for this, like, lack of things, mm-hmm. a lack of sales that might be the result of a boycott. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the South Africa, like, because we're talking about the boycott divest sanction, mm-hmm. which is the BDS movement championed by a lot of Palestinian labor movements. And they have drawn from the fight against apartheid in South Africa. And in a very interesting way, the apartheid legacy kind of continues in Israel, because Israel drew upon the apartheid regime in South Africa to sort of model how it would treat Palestinians. And then naturally, Palestinians also drew upon anti-apartheid movements. So I think there are important distinctions about we're so far from talking about Montreal things. But I think this is still important, because you still have...
It's still relevant, because that's like...
These are tactics being used here.
And activists here, like, they're trying to not revamp, but like refuel the BDS movement. Because it really, like, it's fallen off in the last few years.
There's this great article in The Guardian. I don't know why I looked at the TV like it was going to appear. It's
something
I'm like, if it's in my head, we can get it there. That's later. That's not yet. There's a great article in The Guardian, I believe. It was The Guardian or The Atlantic that talks about the kind of distinct differences between the boycott movements for South Africans and the boycott movement in Palestine. Mm-hmm. Where in South Africa, you had a very broad, high levels of not just South African, but African politics, which were endorsing a boycott. Like, I think the highest office that called for a boycott was from the office of the president of the African National Congress, which is a massive kind of body that, like, includes members from, like, not just South Africa, but a bunch of African countries, right? And meanwhile, because of that, that kind of call to action is being mobilized by multiple levels. Multiple countries, rather. When we look at Palestine, is that call is coming from the highest body it came from is just kind of civil society in Palestine, right? And not to say that because of that it means it can't happen. Of course, it can happen, but there's a very different kind of they're starting off at very different bases. Mm-hmm. They're starting off at very different kind of levels, and mm-hmm. I think for it to be the kind of to have the kind of success that the South African boycott calls had, I think it needs to also come from, like, much larger bodies of power, like maybe like governments would do well to call for it. I think it's unlikely, though. And I think as much as people want to remove themselves from it, I don't think it's as fruitful as some people think it is.
Yeah.
Not to say that people should not keep trying, not to say that it is a wasted effort. I think there is issues about it that people aren't being fully honest with themselves with, you know, because I think a lot of times people want to enable this kind of hope, and they want to stoke kind of like a broader spirit about it. They want to be optimistic about it, which I think is so key to have that in the movement and just also in just everyday life, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think there are ways that I don't know if people have been measuring how people have been measuring success with their actions, mm-hmm. or these kinds of calls. Because I mean, I think we talked about, like, the Starbucks boycott, I think you and I, at least mm-hmm. outside of this.
Yeah, totally.
And I have certain, like, a lot of people I see in, like, who are my, like, little, like, activist circles. Posting about how Starbucks is, like, posting, like, record, like, market losses in the wake of these calls to boycott Starbucks, as they are complicit. But, like, the thing about that is, like, I think what I assume are the Starbucks locations that actually have their pocketbooks directly affected are most likely in Turkey or in kind of, like, certain, like, North African or Middle Eastern kind of countries where they operate in, which have a much larger population base that is sort of against it. I think if you go around, maybe there might be some around, like, downtown Montreal near, like, student campuses that might have a dip in services. But I do, like, I want, like, it's like these companies are, like, the ways that these companies are not only fueled by sales. These companies are much more often fueled by massive investment from, like, just these, like, random, like, boring company names that just sort of, like, move money from one place to another, invest in Starbucks, move that money to another place. And a lot of the times, I think people shouldn't assume that those kinds of market fluctuations are a direct result of boycotts. Not that they can't be,
yeah.
but a lot of times these companies will like lose money like nothing in these markets. And I think people can't always assume that's part of the boycotting. Anyways, mm-hmm. I think there's a larger question of like how you measure success in these kinds of things and how you can remain honest with how your actions are successful or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you brought up like really good points. I think that there are kind of like different levels to the boycott. I know that like when I think that there's like this element of like hypocrisy where it's like people who will go protest on the streets and like support this movement, you know, in their social media or publicly, like any way, but then they might like turn around and go like, you know, line the pockets of like Heather from Chapters, mm-hmm. who, you know, has this organization which supports the Israeli army. I think that there's like, this is an element to it. I think another element is like, I do agree with you, like the boycotts are much more impactful in the Middle East and Morocco, like, you know, Starbucks pulled out of, North Africa, but like Starbucks pulled out of Morocco specifically, mm-hmm. just because they, you know, were not, like, they had so many losses, economical losses.
And that's a real win, right, for the movement.
For sure, it is. I think that there's, like, this interesting cycle I've seen from the boycott, at least, like, locally, where people are much more conscious and specifically in terms of, like, holiday shopping, you know, people, they're not buying from these, like, huge corporations. So it's like, okay, I mean, not everyone was making this choice, but at least some people around me were saying, okay, what are like some local brands I can buy for? So as a result of boycotting, you know, products affiliated with Israel or its military, they're instead like stimulating like small businesses as well as like local businesses. Sure. And as a result of not only stimulating our local economy and like, you know, boosting that here, we're also like relying on less greenhouse gas emissions. So it is like beneficial in other forms. I think I try to be a hopeful person, but I think I'm like, you know, I'm very much a person who's kind of like, I can't die without trying.
That's good.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's good. I don't know. For me, I'm a classic no ethical conception under capitalism kind of guy.
Yeah.
Where there's like, yeah, we like to think of ways that we can consume ethically. It's like, you can't really. So just exist and try the best you can in other spheres.
I think like we have to be realistic, but like, you know, don't die without trying.
Of course.
I do have some statements to share from local activists about what they think about forms of disruptive protesting, if you'd like to hear. The first one is from Sarah Shami. She's an organizer from Palestinian Youth Movement, the Montreal chapter.
She's been on the show, friend of the show, Sarah Shami.
Yeah. Let's check out what she had to say.
You've seen so many forms of disruptive protests, such as, you know, streets, people protesting outside of the home of Melanie Jolie. Why do you think these forms of disruptive protests are so important and essential in this moment?
You know, I think, you know, it's been 3 months of watching this genocide unfold, 3 months of, you know, government's inaction, 3 months of complicity and greenlighting this campaign of genocide. Escalatory actions are actually extremely necessary for us to be able to get our voices heard. And, you know, it's sending a clear message that as long as our demands for an immediate and permanent ceasefire are not being met, we will continue to put pressure on our government by any means necessary.
For the sound, I didn't have my lapel mics, but this was this past weekend outside of the Israeli consulate, where essentially the weekly protest was organized.
What was the question you asked? Because it was kind of hard to make out.
Yeah. Essentially, I asked, what did I ask? Oh, I asked her, like, you know, there's a lot of information circling around in my head. You know, I asked, like, what is the importance of, you know, disruptive protests? And what does she essentially think of them? And, like, are they impactful? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess her answer, I mean, it's interesting she doesn't use the word disruptive. I think what stuck out to me was she said escalatory.
Yeah.
So it's like as if every action has to kind of be like a sort of like a bigger one than the last.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a statement from Dimitri Lascaris. He's a journalist and a lawyer, as well as a former member of the Green Party last week.
Not just member, he ran for the Green Party leadership, finished second.
That as well. Last week, he was protesting outside, as a protest I brought up earlier in the show, the Fairmont Hotel, where Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, as well as other Liberal cabinet members, were essentially a part of like a press conference and a retreat. We didn't see any of them outside the Fairmont, but they were inside. So essentially people, you know, wanted to make noise. They were banging pots and pans. Also, you know, it's René Lévesque, a busy street. So people who were driving by at 9 a.m., you know, late for work, I guess, or just running errands, whatever they were.
You've never been late for work?
No comment. I'm always, anyways. you know, people who were driving by, like they were hearing what was going on. They were seeing the Palestinian flag. They were hearing their chants. So yeah, the audio is much better, but I asked Dimitri what he thought of these forms of protests.
Disruptive protests, you know, such as the one you've been taking part in over the last few months and including today, why are they such an important form of protesting during the war in Gaza?
Well, you have two audiences, basically. There are the people out there in the public who don't know quite what to make of all of this. Of course, some people are very pro-Israel and we're not going to change their minds, no matter what we say or do. Then there's another segment of the population that doesn't need to be persuaded. You know, and they may or may not join us in the protests, but they've already come, you know, to a conclusion based upon the facts. But there's a large swath of the population that doesn't really know. They may lean one way or another, but they don't have a strong view, and they are cognizant of the fact that they don't know a great deal about the history of this entire so-called conflict. That's the audience that we're primarily interested in. When you go out in public, you know, you saw when you were there today, Boulevard René Lévesque, at 9 a.m., there's a lot of traffic. People will see us out there. They'll hear us making noise, waving the Palestinian flag. They'll go, hmm. And they see that often enough, they start asking themselves questions. Why are all these people out in the streets? What are they upset about? Why do they say these things? So we try to stimulate conversation and inquiry by the members of the public whose minds aren't made up. And the other audience, of course, is the political class, the people who are in the building today. We want them to feel the heat. We want them to feel that whenever they appear anywhere publicly, whenever their presence is known to the public, they are going to have to confront protests. And I've said before, and I was gratified to see that somebody actually did this recently, we should actually take this to the doorsteps of their homes. You know, not in anything other than a peaceful manner, and we shouldn't be unduly disruptive, but there were a number of people who peacefully protested at the home of Melanie Joly, the foreign minister, last week. That's the kind of pressure we need so that they can't escape it. Every time, you know, they show their faces, even when they're at home, there are people out there calling them out for supporting a genocidal regime, which is exactly what they're doing.
The importance of disruptive protests. I think it's interesting the way he kind of divides up the audience of these protests, right? He was talking about the... Who's there?
It's locked. So they can't get in.
Nice try. All right. Back to what we're talking about. Dimitri, he was talking about the audience of protests. Mm-hmm. He was talking about, lastly, he named the political class of Melanie Joly, minister, members of parliament, mm-hmm. Who they're trying to put the heat on, the pressure on, making sure they don't know peace too much. Mm-hmm. He continues talking about the action you mentioned before about being outside their homes in a peaceful manner, he says. not unduly disruptive. He mentions the people who might be audience, when I say audience, like witness to these protests, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have the people who are already pro-Palestine, who are, let's say, maybe part of the protests. You have other Palestinian supporters who are just general members of the public. You have the people who are pro-Israel, who will, he is saying, will not have their minds changed by this protest. And then he points out a segment of people who are, I think it's interesting, the undecided, right? Yeah. The kind of people who are undecided or maybe unaware. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about maybe the hopes that, like, if with enough of these are going on, it just kind of perks their ears and they're like, oh, like, this is like, I've seen this flag a bunch. What is mm-hmm. that? Mm-hmm. This has been kind of like, seems to be a recurring thing. And then that might incite them to kind of mm-hmm. go dig deeper and then hopefully find some line of belief about it that would be in line with the pro-Palestinian mm-hmm. one. I wonder
how.
It's because that one is so interesting because it's like, how do you measure that, right? How do you measure like whether or not that's working, like, and how do you measure whether or not that kind of tactic is working for the people who are undecided? And then even then, like the people who are undecided, like let's say they do become decidedly pro-Palestinian, then what? That means more people to leverage, that more people to bother members of parliament. It's like I kind of wonder like. At what point does it reach a critical mass? And I don't think Dimitri knows this. I don't think a lot of people know this. I don't even know this. But it's interesting to think about, like, I guess, I don't know. It's like, I was talking before about what the success rate for that is. How do you measure whether or not that's working? Or I guess, do you even bother measuring it? Or do you just, like you're saying, just, like, try?
I don't know the answer to that question. I guess, honestly, I think just try.
Yeah.
I think, like, a lot of people feel so frustrated, so hopeless, so unsure about the future, the state of our world, given what's going on, Canada's position, multiple Western countries' position, you know, the even what's happening in Yemen, you know, the protests by the Houthis, the response in bombing Yemen. I think that it's like people are almost like we don't know what to do, but we have to make sure people or politicians notably and you know the public around us like knows that enough of us don't agree with this.
Right.
I think like something I've been noticing and what I brought up earlier in the protest is like so many large outlets not accurately reporting the amount of people who are attending these protests. Mm-hmm. Like I think it's inaccurately representing how many people, you know, support Palestinian liberation. Whereas, okay, you may not go to your news and read accurate numbers from, you know, various media outlets, but you may be in the street each day and it might be harder and harder not to come across one of these demonstrations. Whether it's small or not, you know, you kind of have this like visual reminder, oh, this is still going on. Mm-hmm. Even if like my algorithm is not showing me, you know, what's happening in Gaza, because I prefer to look away, I prefer to not engage with these posts, or, you know, my local media outlet is not accurately representing how many people are participating in these protests, like I'm running my groceries and seeing, you know, having people remind me, like, this is still an issue. Mm-hmm. People are still dying, and we're still trying to apply pressure. So I know that doesn't really answer your question,
no,
how
but
much
I
is it working, but it's like, we got to do something.
Of course. I think for me, when I ask, like, the question of how is it working, it's not to say that we shouldn't try anything, right? But it's more the idea of, like, if we're trying something, and it is not quite working to the level that we want it to work. Because, like, I think the risk is, if you don't have any way to like define success or gains in momentum, then how do you like when do you know when to abandon that tactic to try and pick up another one to try and keep like the gains going, right? That's I think it's more in line with that where my concern is like you have movements who try to use a tactic and they're just try and try and try and because they have no metric of like measuring it. And it's a difficult thing to measure that kind of stuff. But if you have no tactic of measuring it, you have no way of kind of quantifying what is a win or what is gains, then how do you know when to abandon the tactic, you know? And that's why I kind of wonder with the PYM, maybe I should ask them directly, but like, when do you decide to switch a tactic?
Yeah.
Maybe it might be more intuition. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's like roll of the dice, some tarot cards they pick up.
Where are your tarot cards?
I didn't bring mine with me today.
She got office tarot cards.
I should. That's a good idea.
I do think something interesting that he did bring up in the interview is, you know, like people who disagree, like I forget exactly what he said, but, you know, like we can't change their mind.
Right.
I think that was interesting. He identified that and then kind of like moved along, like, okay, so the undecided people, mm-hmm. like this is where we try and get them on board. I think like I've been seeing interesting reactions, especially like it's always chaos in my TikTok comments, honestly.
on your posts?
Yeah, on like the coverage of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. You know, a lot of people will kind of fight and, you know, not exactly like a combative, but like, you know, verbally combative,
sure, disagree.
You know,
just being on the internet does that. When you don't know the other person, when the other person is just like a concept that you're just talking at, and then people just get riled up.
Absolutely. And I've seen, you know, both on TikTok and Instagram especially, I'm sure it's happening on other social media platforms as well, but, you know, these kind of just like back and forth. I've had like, I think my comments have been turned off, like I only, you know, get some of the highlights, but I do see like frequent commenters and they're just back and forth at each other. And I mean, this is a thought I've had, but also like I've seen, you know, some people comment on different posts as well. Like, don't engage with the people who disagree, because as soon as you do that, it gets like boosted in the algorithm. Right. Like, this is going to come up first. This is these negative comments, you know, disagreeing comments are what people are going to read first when they come to the post. So it's like, don't even engage. And it's like Dimitri is having this kind of reaction where he's not like identifying, you know, don't engage on social media, but he's just kind of like has this attitude of, you know, it's not worth my time.
Right.
Like, they could have these conversations on their own, but I think what I've experienced with people who disagree is almost this form of like shutting off. So all you can really do is like be patient. If they come around, they want to talk, you know, they can, but there's not really any point in like wasting your energy when it's like, as he said, you know, this undecided group, this is where we're going to try and focus and Absolutely. Get that support and, you know, have these people call their MPs, have them talk with their family member, these friends, join in actions.
Yeah. I think it's something really important to know about, like, I think the people who disagree, especially online, especially if you don't really know them, your effect on them, I mean, unless you're like so like charismatic and you know how to like just like undress someone with like an argument, I think the people who will have a easier time of changing that person's mind, the person who's like incredibly like whose opinions are, let's say, like opposite of yours, are going to be the people closest in their lives, are going to be the people they see regularly, right? And so what's important is for people to think about, like, okay, who do I see regularly? What long-term conversations can I have that can generally, like, where you get to express the full range of facts, politics, history behind an issue, where you can get them to change their mind on it, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I think his point is good, because it's like a lot of times we want to, it's like the idea of like being, of changing someone's mind just like that with an argument or like just like in an instant is like, so it's like, it's an appealing idea,
mm-hmm.
right? But mm-hmm. a lot of times it takes much more work than people, I think, assume.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so it's good that he brings that up. And the people who are undecided, who are sort of on the fence, are a little easier to talk to about this. Mm-hmm. Not always, but sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 100%. This last statement is from a member who wanted to remain anonymous, from Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, the UCAM University chapter. This person had kind of a bit of a different opinion than the two former people I interviewed. This interview was done by Aude Simon, one of our video journalists.
Shout out Aude.
Yeah.
What do you think of forms of disruptive protests as we see these in Montreal, like blocking the roads, making noise, protesting outside politicians' homes? What is your opinion on those type of protests?
You know, it's a really tricky situation, because I don't personally believe in, like, I didn't go to these events, whatever, because I don't take part in these types of things. But then I have to answer the questions, why are these things happening? Because also I can immediately say that, like, you know, they are making very clear and easy demands that are not being met by the people in government and the people in parliament. And I think that this is really frustrating. So I can understand the reason behind it, which is why I'm like, you know, like, have an open discussion and talk about these things and listen, actually. And I think this is like a really big problem in our society today, because, for example, the Democrats in the USA, almost 60% of their voting base want a ceasefire, and they won't even say the word. So I really think there's a big problem in democracy nowadays, which, you know, how do you mediate that? How do you tell the Democrats who want something from their representatives who won't listen to them?
Democracy. Yeah, I mean, totally fair. I mean, pointing out the American democratic system, which is, I think, not the world's favorite. it's interesting. I guess he's not talking less. He's talking less about the disruptive protests themselves, right? Because he doesn't seem to attend them, but more about the need for them, or I guess the situation that kind of brings them up.
Yeah, it was a bit vague. I think kind of what I took from this is that maybe this person doesn't totally agree with them, which is why they may not attend them, but they sympathize and they, like, understand.
Right. The need for that kind of pressure. Sure. It's interesting hearing these kinds of varied opinions on disruptive protests. I mean, it seems across the board, people do seem, at least the people CTV interviewed, seem sort of in favor of them.
Yeah.
I guess time and place for them. I don't know if I have much more else to add that we haven't touched upon already.
No, we were pretty in depth. I guess I'll keep you updated if there's some type of new form of disruptive or, what did Sarah say?
Escalatory.
Escalatory protest.
Yeah. What's a non-disruptive protest? Think about it. All right, thank you very much, everyone.
Let us know in the comments, I guess. I can't think of one, can you?
Yeah. No. I mean, just like staying at home, I don't know.
Is that protesting?
No, exactly. I think protesting is kind of necessarily, like, sort of disruptive, at least.
Yeah.
Disrupting the sound.
Yeah.
The quiet, the peace of a neighborhood.
I know that there was a form where people, like, a week of action, like, don't go to school, don't go to work. You know, that's staying at home, but that's still disrupting because you're not, you know, maybe school is not, that's like affecting yourself. You're not doing the learning that you paid for, but if you don't go to work, like, that's disrupting the business you work for.
Of course, yeah. Their operational capacity is disrupted by that.
So I don't think there's a
fun. I think there's a lot of interesting kind of threads between Felix's, our previous Felix Fox, talking about strikes. And strikes, I mean, strikes themselves are a sort of disruptive action, right? But, like, strikes, very similar to, like, the Bombardier and Lockheed Martin actions, are sort of, like, pointed. There's, like, a very specific thing that is being leveraged between a large group of people and, let's say, like, a workplace or a company, which I think is interesting to think about in terms of the kinds of disruptions that are effective. Mm-hmm. It did seem like the Common Front strikes were effective. They seemed, I mean, of course, concessions were made, but, you know, they were able to get some of their demands in.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Savannah, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Leading this discussion on disruptive protests. And thank you, listener, for listening to myself, our guests, sort of ramble about different politics in Montreal. Make sure to follow us on our social media pages. And just have yourself a good weekend. I'll see you next week.